You're listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me today are Jeff Renke and Andy Zoll. We're the editors of Manufacturing.net and IEN, and we have each 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we cover the five top stories in manufacturing and the implications that they have on the industry moving forward. Please make sure you like, subscribe, share the podcast. You could also help us a lot by giving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. Finally, to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, Anna, or Andy at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also reach David at David at IEN.com. He would probably love to hear from you home, thick in bed right now. We're live every Thursday, so subscribe on YouTube at IEN Magazine to get a notification. We try to start sometime in the afternoon, if that helps. Andy, thanks for coming today. Last minute, how are you doing?
Last minute pinch hitting. No worries. I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Doing good, Jeff.
I'm just a little worried about David. I knew that this was bad when he missed two straight softball games. Like, you know, before it's kind of okay, maybe a summer cold type thing, but man, he tried coming in today and made the right call, I think, turning around.
It was good to see him for a couple of seconds, because not a lot of radio, a lot of radio silence out of him for a couple days.
So, you know, he was definitely feeling it.
Yeah. He's alive, but sweaty and at home again. So, all right. Well, before we get started, we're going to go to a quick word from our sponsor, BigCommerce. BigCommerce provides modern e-commerce technology that works with your existing systems. ERP, OMS, CRM, no problem. Whatever existing business tools and technologies you use today, BigCommerce can integrate using pre-built one-click integrations or customize your automation with its APIs. Make the move to BigCommerce today. All right, guys, are you ready?
I am ready. Fired up.
Yep.
Doing it for David.
Here we go.
Doing it for David. This is like it's a fun run.
If I was cool and hip, I'd say like hashtag, but that just doesn't sound right coming from me.
Okay. Yeah, well, okay. Just doing it for David then.
Yeah. Just
totally.
No sounds, hashtag social media involved.
Sounds totally cool as is.
Just.
All right. So our first story this week, the fifth most popular story on our websites, was titled Family Faces Prison After Recycling Scheme Defrauds Program of $7.6 million. A family that operates recycling centers in California has been implicated in the attempt to capitalize on the state's beverage container recycling program. At issue here is Cal Recycle, a California program that incentivizes recycling at privately owned centers by offering a 5 or 10 cent return on beverage containers. So during an 8-month period, 8 family members brought some 178 tons of aluminum cans and plastic bottles from Arizona to be recycled. Only material from California is eligible for the redemption. I think we probably could have guessed that, right? A California Justice Department investigation determined that the family's alleged actions defrauded the CalRecycle program of approximately $7.6 million. DOJ agents also seized about $1 million and additional illegally imported beverage containers during a search. The suspects, who are aged 23 to 58, now face multiple charges that include recycling fraud, grand theft, and conspiracy. CalRecycle also plans to carry out action against the involved recycling centers. So, Andy, let's talk a little bit about recycling fraud.
I wonder, because this isn't the first time this has happened, obviously, if there's a charge called recycling fraud, yes?
Right. It seems like this is maybe more common than we know.
More common than you would think. I was excited to dig into this story, but I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to wait till we actually go to court or it's settled here, because the criminal complaint doesn't leave, or it doesn't disclose a lot of the juicier details that you'd hope to see, like how this family was transporting almost 180 tons of recyclables through the Mojave Desert. It doesn't disclose what kind of vehicles are involved, how many trips it took. It also doesn't really get into how investigators got wise to this, who tipped them off, or how, what kind of discrepancies led them to start investigating these recycling yards in Riverside County. There's also reference to some unknown person or persons early in the complaint. So that might have something to do with that, but we're just kind of left to read the tea leaves here so far. But also, this kind of sounds like an innocent enough scheme as schemes go until you see the bags of bound cash. Yeah. That might be a tip that what you're doing is not altogether on the level.
Yeah, that was my initial thought, too. I'm like, maybe they didn't know, but it's pretty clear that they did know. And, you know, surprising, I guess, Jeff, that more of this doesn't happen.
Yeah, and then we don't hear about it more, I guess. You know, just taking a minute, though, this massive fraud aside, isn't it a little heartwarming to see that the family unit is alive and well in America? Eight members of this family just taking road trips from Arizona to California. Just there had to be a lot of good times there. Don't you think?
Like they have like audiobooks that they would listen to. And
maybe they're playing a little I Spy on the way.
Yeah, license plate game. I didn't really see it that way, but
let's look for the glass half full side of this.
It's probably a very nice drive.
There you go. You know.
Through the desert.
Yeah. Massive fraud aside. Mm-hmm. The other thing that it actually kind of made me a little nostalgic, I was thinking about recycling aluminum cans. Did you guys do that when you were kids? Like, you know, you'd be the one in charge of crushing all the cans and taking them.
Yes, I love to crush them, yeah.
Yeah, taking them in, get a couple extra bucks to go to Music Land or something like that, you know, to the mall. But this was obviously a much bigger scale. I mean, we've talked about aluminum and just sort of the supply chain dynamic that's been in place here for the last couple of years. I mean, we talked about craft breweries, a couple of different stories over the last month. One of the things, probably 18 months ago, that was really hurting some of these smaller breweries or canning facilities was they could not get enough aluminum cans. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was crazy. So you can see as the price of aluminum went up a little bit, you can see why maybe they would have been drawn to this scheme, not justifying it in any way, shape, or form. But you can see why it did finally get some attention, especially when you look at the fact that, you know, we struggle with aluminum in this country just because we don't have the bauxite, which is one of the key chemicals that's imported pretty much that was causing a lot of the supply chain issues. The other thing is we look at about 70% of the aluminum cans that we have actually come from recycled materials. So there's obviously the demand from these recycling centers. The other thing you're looking at is price. If you go in and just kind of recycle these cans on your own, you're getting about 40 cents a pound. Whereas when you look at what they were getting at 5 cents a can, you know, that can be about $1.50 difference per pound. So there was some pretty good money to be made by ripping off Cal Recycle. Obviously, good that they were found out, good that they're identified. It's another one of those schemes where you feel like if they just would have eased off the gas a little bit, they probably could have gotten away with some stuff,
which
it's probably a good thing. Criminals are stupid, so they did get caught. But a lot of interesting things here just around aluminum and what this can potentially create. And you wonder if we will see more of these things or if people are just being smarter than these folks were and not getting caught.
Do you think that you would be really good at recycling fraud?
I think I could.
Yeah.
I think I could.
Mm-hmm. Backup plan.
Plus, I'd love the road trips. Obviously, I kind of let that slip. I'm kind of a big fan. So get some Funyuns and some Snapple and we're in good shape.
Right.
That's a haul from here to California, though. You'd have to
work out something closer.
Yeah.
Michigan does some fun recycling stuff.
That's how unknown persons get involved in these things. That's where you get tripped up.
I don't have enough unknown persons. That's what I would need. No, just kidding.
In a press release that was published by the state of California, Attorney General Rob Bonta was quoted as saying, California's recycling program is funded by consumers and helps protect our environment and our communities. And I think that's the important thing to remember, that schemes like this really deplete the funds from programs like these that are generated locally. Yeah. And that 5 and 10 cent, you know, what they get back on each of those items, that's probably a surcharge that's built into the cost of those items. Typically, that's how it works in those states. So that money is supposed to be cyclical and stay in that system. And so you can really disrupt that with schemes like this. So I think you got to remember, too, that not only was this boneheaded, but like for the recycling industry, which, as you said, aluminum is very, a very strong candidate for recycling. A big chunk of it actually gets reused. You know, we want to encourage people to continue to do that, see these programs get compromised because they do improve compliance, I think. Yeah. And also, you know, I felt a little bit, I took like a sadder take on the family dynamic. It just, I know that you were, I know you were kidding. no, when I heard that there was a 23-year-old involved, it just like bummed me out, you know, because you'd think that the elders in this family could be setting a better precedent for, you know, this kid who's probably, I know, an adult technically, but, you know, maybe feeling some tremendous pressure to be involved in this.
Well, this isn't the type of offense that goes away either. Right. You know, when you have these types of agencies involved, yeah, this is going to stick with them for a while.
These are felony charges.
I know. I mean, that's not exactly, that's like a bad record now. So do better, parents. All right. Our next most popular story is titled Roller Coaster with Big Crack Has a Second Structural Issue, inspectors say. So we just talked about the original story a couple weeks back. So we're getting an update on that. So another structural issue has been located with a large roller coaster that's been closed for weeks since a large crack in a support column was discovered. So park staff closed the Fury 325 on June 30th after a visitor pointed out the sizable crack. Within weeks, a new support column was delivered and installed. So in the process of attempting to review and approve the fix, the North Carolina Department of Labor says that it has been notified of a separate, quote, weld indication, which could be either a crack or a break. Carowinds, which is the name of the park, said it was conducting a full maintenance review of the ride while test runs are being performed. And during such reviews, said the park, it is not uncommon to discover slight weld indications in various locations of a steel superstructure. They add that these indications do not compromise the structural integrity or safety of the ride. And I would add, necessarily. I don't know that we know that yet. Inspections by the park, the engineering company, a third-party testing firm, and the Department of Labor have been ongoing. And Carowinds has said that it is changing how it inspects rides daily, including the use of drone cameras to examine areas. So, Andy, when you saw this, what was your initial reaction?
Well, I wasn't here for your discussion a week or two ago, whatever it was. So
you did tune in, though, right?
We absolutely tuned in, always listening. It's
in case you weren't, we just told you that you are.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's difficult, or rather, I'm not sure how much of this you've already gone over with the initial story that was reported here, but I mean, just that these things are routine, almost, that they're kind of downplaying this second incident. It might it suggests to me, at least, that maybe they should step up their inspection game a little bit. This thing passed its annual inspection, I believe, in February was the original story. And I mean, if no one recognized the initial much more serious issue, and then this apparently less serious issue is still going on despite all of that, despite all that attention, just might be. And I know it's difficult to get together the manpower to do those sorts of inspections, and there was demands on governments and all that sorts of thing. But maybe a biannual or a biennial, right?
Yeah.
Instead of or quarterly, something to that effect.
More.
Yes.
More.
Mass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big roller coaster guy. So my
is this helping?
You know, it's not. I don't think it's hurting. But it's not helping, but it's not hurting either. I mean,
did you get a chance to check out like the POV of actually going on this roller coaster?
I did not. I do like those videos, though. I don't like when I'm personally sitting in the seat, but I'll watch the
POV. Just the slow elevation I hate that. Just get there already. Man, that freaks me out. Even when watching the video.
Jeff, what did you think about the Department of Labor's characterization of what it is that we're dealing with here?
Well, first of all, I thought it was kind of interesting that we have a different spokesperson. Mm-hmm. The first story, we were talking about the commissioner of the Department of Labor. On this one, it's more of just a spokesperson, Meredith Watson, as opposed to the commissioner who is
hiding in his office.
Yeah, Josh Dobson. I mean, he was kind of all over this first story, kind of being reassuring. Yeah, we're going to look into it. Now, maybe the Department of Labor has more important things to focus on than a roller coaster, which is fine. But I just like to probe a little bit there because it just, you know, what is going on there in terms of this ongoing investigation? The other thing that caught my attention, and maybe this is, again, me kind of looking or overthinking the situation a little bit, but they called it a weld indication. Mm-hmm. I hate these terms because just say what it is. Is it a crack? Is it a bad weld? Is something coming apart? What's going on? They had some sort of vague language and they're like, it could indicate this or that. say what it is. And this bothers me because whenever we talk about these safety stories, and we're going to have another one here coming up, and we talk about how culture can permeate throughout some of these organizations and make safety less significant than what it should be, mm-hmm. I feel like these types of terms help with that.
Yeah.
They really do. As opposed to really calling it out and addressing it more quickly, we have to be, you know, sensitive to all the different dynamics and not go too far out there in terms of we don't know exactly what it is. But using a weak term like that doesn't help really bring the sense of urgency that it should. If it's important enough to shut this down and people's lives are at risk, treat it as such. And use some stronger language anyway to make these parks, and not just these parks, any place of work, focus more on how important and how significant these things are. Not just saying, well, we shut it down, we'll figure it out, don't mm-hmm. worry about it. No, say, look, you got a bad weld here. The thing's going to crack and fall over. Fix it. Call it what it is.
I agree with you generally, but I think that what they're trying to do is exactly the opposite of that. They don't want to create a bunch of panic around this. And I think they're trying to say, we don't really know what this is yet. So let's just call it a weld indication and then we'll let you know. I mean, that exactly what they're doing, though.
That is what they're doing.
Whether you agree or not. Yeah.
I just don't think it helps. I think that's what helps create some of these weak safety cultures that I've definitely been critical of.
They could have workshopped that phrase a little more.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I see where you're not trying to, if it's not, you know, I'm not an engineer, so if it's not technically a break or a crack or what have you, like, that's fine, but maybe work on that phrasing a little bit.
How about
weld indicator?
What about unconscious uncoupling?
How about a weak-ass weld?
Weak-ass weld.
There you go.
Yeah.
This whole thing was interesting to me because I know that when we initially talked about this story, Jeff, you and I were in agreement about how alarming it was, how quickly they were able to replace that column. Yeah. So they determined that there was a problem, right? But they went right back to the exact same manufacturer that they used for the first one. They figured it out immediately, according to them. And then they had that that fix there right away within, 7 or 8 days or something. They were starting to swap those out. And so we were both feeling like that wasn't super reassuring to us as consumers. Like, I don't think I would feel good about getting back on that ride, no matter what they said. It just felt like they were maybe rushing it a little bit. And then to see this, and I know they're trying to downplay it, like, as you said, making it sound like this is routine. Maybe, but if that's the case, I guess why has it been disclosed to the media? Why is the Department of Labor
this heavily involved with
talking
it.
About yeah. it? Yeah, it just if it were like a something that you see every day and it's really easy to fix.
It almost reads like how skyscrapers have a little bit of sway built into it, and it's just mm-hmm. kind of the cost of doing, or it's kind of, routine, as they kind of mentioned.
When it's this
here.
Visible, though, that's where it gets alarming. And especially that previous one, man, that was frightening.
That was scary. Yeah. So. Yeah. I will not be getting on the roller coaster anytime soon, but that's
shocking.
I wasn't going to get
on. I can't
anyway.
Believe that. That really blows me away.
I was going to just skip that. We have a comment in from Mark Waterman, who's watching us live. Thanks for tuning in today, Mark. Maybe it had been on order for weeks, perhaps, except for that I don't think they knew about the crack for weeks. And also, to me, if it happened, based on it being the exact same product that was produced by the exact same manufacturer, and they figured out why the weld cracked right away. I don't know. It just seemed too quick to me, but
that
you're right. It could be legit. I don't know. But.
That didn't read to me as rushed. It read like, much like our recycling fraud, it had not been unheard of before, which is somehow more unsettling.
Well, our next story, we're going to cover another very alarming and scary safety incident. So buckle up. Crane collapse linked to company and operator with a history of safety violations. A tower crane owned by New York Crane and Equipment Corporation was recently hoisting concrete to the 36th story of a luxury high-rise when a fire broke out in the machine's cab. Flames burned through a cable holding the crane's arm in place, sending the 180-foot-long boom crashing to the ground, raining thousands of pounds of steel debris onto a busy thoroughfare. Miraculously, no one was seriously injured. That's unbelievable. The crane's owner-operator is now being scrutinized as the event has stirred alarming memories, specifically two of the city's most disastrous crane collapses, back-to-back incidents in 2008, where 9 people died. Both involved cranes owned by New York Crane and Equipment Corporation. Adding to that, later that year, a construction worker fell to his death while helping dismantle a crane owned by a different company. One of the 2 crane operators whose license was suspended for 8 months was Chris Van Doon. The same man was operating the crane that caught fire Wednesday, officials said. So following the consecutive collapses 15 years ago, New York adopted a series of stringent crane requirements that go beyond those of other states, according to industry experts. Still, city leaders are expressing concern, with one city council member asking why a company with a history of injuries and fatalities on site is continuing to do business in the city of New York. One expert said that the regulations, which require multiple city-specific licenses and high insurance liability, may have had the unintended consequence of keeping new companies from entering New York's market, effectively allowing a small number of players to dominate the industry. The fire's cause is still under investigation. In the meantime, neither the crane company nor its operators have been publicly accused of wrongdoing. I think we might see more information about that come out. But so far, what are your initial thoughts on this, Jeff?
So initially looking into this, I was surprised that it was just the crane operator that was being so heavily scrutinized. In these types of situations, when we see a piece of equipment malfunction, it's also the manufacturer of that equipment that draws a lot of fire. If this was the automotive side of things, if this was Ford or GM, they would be even more in the headlines than the actual crane operator. I'm not trying to give them a free pass in any way, shape, or form. They need to be held just as accountable as anybody else. But when you look at these previous incidents here, as well as some other crane disasters around the world, one of the common denominators is the manufacturer of these cranes. This is a Favel Favco crane. Okay. This company has been indicated in a number of issues with crane malfunctions, accidents, whatever you want to say. The other thing they've come out and they've said is a high-ranking official told CBS New York that the preliminary cause of the fire is hydraulic fluid that leaked onto a hot plate near the engine of the crane. So they're saying that the incident appears accidental, no suspected criminality. But my thinking is, if you had leaking hydraulic fluid in a place where it can hit something that's so hot, and if you saw the video of this fire, man, it was a fireball that went up, and it's hot enough to sever the cable holding this crane, that's on the manufacturer, at least in some way, shape, or form. Something went wrong here. So I think as we get into this a little bit more, I think you're going to become familiar with Favco cranes and some of the things that from an engineering or product design perspective, seem like they need to be doing better. Mm-hmm. Okay, this isn't just operator error. There's other things involved here. Like you alluded to, it is an absolute miracle after watching the footage that only 12 people received minor injuries and that there wasn't more to it. There's definitely a shared responsibility here. Obviously, the crane operator cannot get a pass in any way, but we got to look at the equipment as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Andy, what are your thoughts about this scenario and these companies that are in play here?
So it's been 15 years since these 2 disasters involving this company in New York. And there's a lot of obviously legal back and forth in the wake of those, not only from City Hall's perspective, but just in the, you know, hashing out liability. And so there were, you know, accusations of the people running the cranes and then also them defending themselves by pointing out what appear to be, you know, cutting corners, outright ignoring issues altogether. So we're still so early in this that it's, you know, you're obviously going to have to wait weeks, months, however long for an investigation to kind of hash out what happened. But it's tricky not to jump to conclusions based on what happened, you know, with this company in the past. What I couldn't stop thinking about was you're this guy, Chris Van Doon, Van Doyne. Mm-hmm. You were implicated in this disaster 15 years ago. Like, what are the odds that you're in this exact 15 years later?
Right.
And you're in a different crane disaster. And it appears to be not your fault from the initial reading of it. I mean, what are the odds? Like, how bad a day did that guy have?
Yeah.
Well, so that's what I couldn't stop thinking about the odds of that.
Like, how is that?
I don't know how many crane operators there are in New York City.
Is there something more to it then? Again, when you get back to the operator,
and we have to wait for that. If early indications are that it's just accidental, that's just a run of really, really terrible luck, but we'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was an interesting quote in the article from Stephen Smith, the executive director of the Center for Building in North America. And he said, I think along the lines of your point, Andy, crane collapses are not that frequent. So if multiple high profile accidents happen with the same company, you have to wonder if we're not keeping out more competent operators and firms. So speaking to the recurring nature of these incidents, but also some of the regulations that have been handed down in response to that, and whether they're having an unintended consequence here of blocking certain operators from the market.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair point, although the reason these crane company regulations were enacted initially was because of problematic safety issues. All that other stuff, you know, the deaths and, you know, that stuff all took place before these regulations. And, you know, there really hasn't been anything significant as far as I know since that took place. So it's hard to say, like, just because this one thing happened that the problem is now the regulations. I don't know if that's quite, you know, that's a pretty big jump. So I think that maybe, you know, I'll give him his point, but maybe add some context there. Still, if true, you know, how can local legislators maybe better police this process so they are not creating an environment where only a handful of companies can kind of run the show, and then everyone's kind of held hostage by that, you know, safety issues or not? They have to figure that out, because, you know, as we were discussing, it was truly a miracle that nobody, not just the people who are working on the crane platform or with, you know, but also like how many people were underneath,
just
like
passersby. Yeah,
I mean,
it's crazy.
New York is like the most walked city, I think, in America. That could have been really terrible. So,
no, it's definitely a sticky situation, because you get into these projects where you need somebody who's got the money up front that can actually have this equipment and have the workforce and the expertise. That right there sort of limits the scope of individual companies that can handle this type of work. More regulation, more legislation doesn't help broaden that pool.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there has to be a level of accountability that supersedes just, hey, do the right thing, man. You know,
right.
Just because you are a larger company. So that's, it's an ongoing challenge. And you know, New York has such a reputation for being a very pure, democratically focused political organization. There's never any kind of shady dealings or anything questionable that happens there.
For sure.
So I'm sure this is all above board as well.
And moving on to our next story.
Yeah, I watched The Sopranos.
That's New Jersey.
They were in New York.
They were going to port to the city, though.
We'll use it as fact-based evidence. All right. our next most popular story, truck parts maker fined $1 million for selling rolling coal devices. This was a video that Ben Munson put together on a company called Sinister Diesel. So we'll start there. Sinister Diesel. A California-based truck parts manufacturer has been slapped with a $1 million fine for selling devices that defeat a vehicle's emissions controls. So for 10 years, Sinister manufactured and sold defeat devices that allow vehicles like diesel trucks to dramatically increase the amount of pollutants that they put in the air. The practice, which is often referred to as rolling coal, can cause engines to emit massive black clouds of exhaust fumes. We've all seen it, right? According to the U.S. Justice Department, Sinister also sold delete kits that sometimes came bundled with delete tunes, third-party software that can make a vehicle with defeated emissions controls appear to run normally. The company is also accused of advising customers on the deleting process and on how to get around state emissions tests. The DOJ said EPA testing shows that a vehicle with defeated emissions controls can give off more than 100 times the amount of air pollutants as compared to a vehicle running normally. The company pleaded guilty to conspiracy to violate the Clean Air Act and to tampering with emissions monitoring devices on diesel trucks. I don't even know where to begin, because I just like seething, even just reading about this.
First of all, are you upset that Sinister Diesel was taken as a company name, that you can't somehow emulate that in some way for any of your future ventures?
Maybe they'll get shut down at some point here and I can just take it.
You can grab that.
Yeah. So Andy, when you, besides being like just frustrated and angry, like I think a lot of us were, like, what were your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, Sinister Diesel is an incredible company name, just for the record.
It sounds more like a Vin Diesel movie.
It does. That's why it's a good company name.
Okay. Fair enough.
Vinister Diesel.
You,
it's his middle name.
His full name is Vinister Diesel. It's a good one.
You would hope that this kind of fine would serve as a deterrent to other companies to do this sort of thing. But this is a settlement, and also this is not the first one of these fines handed out to one of these companies. There was, I forget the name of the company off the top of my head, but they had a reality show. I believe they were based in Utah, and it wasn't $1 million, but it was something like $800,000, something like that. So I have my doubts that this, while it's a hefty penalty, I have my doubts that it will keep different companies from doing this sort of thing, given that the market appears to be out there for this sort of thing. And I know the issue here is defeat devices, which we've talked about here and elsewhere ad nauseum after the Volkswagen controversy and all that. But, well, first of all, before I get into that, I didn't know the term for this was rolling coal. That is the worst, the absolute worst. And it's banned, I think, in three states. There's no reason for that to exist. No. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Everyone who does it is a terrible, aggressive driver. It's the worst.
I
don't know if that's a hot take.
We are making friends today.
I don't think that's a particularly hot take. Who sees one of those and is like, that's a quality human being? Andy. Right? I didn't know that was a hot take.
That's, I would not criticize the human being directly after seeing what they're driving.
Man.
Okay, so
anyone come on a road trip with me.
Anybody who's watching and is simultaneously rolling coal,
email me.
Yeah, just let us know why. We want to know why.
Andy wants to meet you really badly.
Well,
sorry, I didn't have an appropriate segue back to the legal implications here after that.
See, and I thought I was going to come out aggressive here, but I can't really top that.
Jeff, Try to top it.
All I was going to say is I can't believe we're talking about fines for this. I mean, if we are in a place where, as a society, we have made laws that say you can't have emissions levels at this point. Now, we've only got 33 out of the 50 states that have these levels of testing. Even within these states, not all of them have the emissions testing in place. But overall, if we're saying we don't want these vehicles to be emitting these types of emissions, how can these kits, to your point, even be available?
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is we're talking about fines. The EPA actually has the power to shut down businesses. Okay, just like OSHA has the ability to take criminal action for safety infractions. Now, if the violation is particularly severe or the company has no regard for environmental law, the EPA can take action against a business that could result in its closure. If you've been selling cheat devices for 10 years, I think that qualifies for no regard for environmental law. Okay, that's my opinion. The other thing that's really kind of frustrating is I can go to bigdaddydiesel.com right now and buy one of these cheat devices for $1,300. And that's like the base model. Mm-hmm. The fact that all of these things are out there, if we're making laws against them, how are they even available? How can people, and I know why it is, it's for people who are doing tuners. There's a lot of people who still want to do diesel hot rods, and a lot of these cheat devices actually help them improve their MPGs and actually make the car perform better, sans emissions concerns, okay? So that's why they're there. But if we're, like I said, if we're going to take this approach and we're going to make things illegal, don't even make them available. Make it illegal to sell. Go after some of these companies and these kits and just make it a universal approach. That's how we're going to enact change here.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that as we learn more about the role of emissions in public health, that maybe there needs to be a change to the law here where, and this maybe is also going to be a hot take, but like that to pursue and purchase these types of devices, you know, then the lawmakers can go after their customer list, you know, like people, because there's a market for it, there will always be people who will produce it. Yeah. And if there's no ramifications that reach the consumer or the buyer, there will continue to be a market, whether that's above board or black market or whatever, that's going to always exist. Yeah. I think they got to make it a little bit harder for people and enact some barriers, to prevent people from even going after this stuff in the first place. Because again, 100 times the amount of emissions from one vehicle. And then, you know, the rest of us are out here like sorting our recyclables and trying to, you know what I mean? Like riding our bikes to work and stuff. And to think that your efforts are being completely counteracted times 100 by one person who just does not care. That's really infuriating. And so I think that there could be more done to address.
No, I agree. And I'm usually on the other side of these, but it's like, if we've got the science and we're seeing, hey, we shouldn't do this. And the thing is, it's not even illegal all over the place as far as these emissions testing. So the need for these devices isn't even a necessary in a large geographical area. Yeah, just out ban them. Just ban them outright.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And when the automakers did this, like you mentioned, I know that a lot of that was because they got into a lot of trouble because they did not disclose what they were doing. Everybody was like furious about it. So you can be furious about this too.
It cost them a couple billion. So.
A light couple billion, yeah. We got a note from Joe S., who's watching us live, and he said, thanks for the koozie. You are welcome. I hope that's keeping your drink cold. I hope it's keeping your drink cold right now. All right. So our last story of the week, our most popular story, is about Anheuser-Busch, who is cutting hundreds of jobs. Anheuser-Busch has announced plans to cut hundreds of jobs. Frontline staff won't be impacted, according to the company. So brewery and warehouse workers, as well as field sales and drivers, are safe. The company says it's laying off less than 2% of employees, primarily corporate staff, in an effort to simplify the organization. The company has some 19,000 employees in the U.S. I think that leaves about, they think, estimated about 380 layoffs. Anheuser-Busch CEO Brendan Whitworth called the decision, quote, difficult but necessary in order to set the company up for long-term success. The company remains in the throes of a Bud Light marketing fiasco that has dethroned the brand as the top-selling beer in America, a position it held for more than 20 years. Jeff, when you first saw that these layoffs were taking place, did you see a direct tie to the drama around marketing, or do you think there's more to it?
I think that when you get this much scrutiny, and the one thing with the Dylan Mulvaney sponsorship was one thing, but then when there was fallout that was also being talked about to such an extent, losing the number one ranking, all of that, I think with that becomes important to a different demographic, not necessarily your customers, but everybody who has a financial stake in your company, mm-hmm. stockholders, other individuals. So it seems like when that happens, when you do have some of these big misses, everything gets looked at, everything gets scrutinized. And all of a sudden, if you can see and sort of change the narrative a little bit to stop talking about those things and start talking about, well, you know what? We need to tighten things up here. Okay. We need to do some things internally and get our ship right. That takes on a new narrative. Okay. So that's what this feels like to me in terms of seeing some of these redundancies, if you will, in terms of cutting jobs. It's a different type of headline that isn't necessarily positive, but it's in response to, we do need to do something to show that we're responding to the fact we're going to get better. We're going to preserve profits. All of those types of things, again, to make some of the financial folks happy. The interesting thing is their stock price is only down about 4% year over year. So it really hasn't been that dramatic from a profitability perspective, although they have lost sales. The other thing that's really interesting, and you have to kind of bring it up with Bud Light because of everything around that sponsorship that got them in trouble, they still are sponsoring like 27 or 28 of the 32 NFL teams. They've got new sponsorships with soccer, mm-hmm. other things around the world, new country music entertainers and concerts that are being sponsored by Bud Light. So they haven't shifted gears a ton. It was just this one that obviously drew the ire of a lot of people. And I think this was just in response to, again, the overall narrative of what's Bud Light going to do in response to the fact that they're no longer number one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you make some good points around there was because the being dethroned news was so heavily reported that I do think there was this suggestion or implication that Bud Light was somehow in free fall. Right. And you're right. They needed to do something to kind of like, nope, here we're stopping you right there. Here's what we're doing. This is how we're going to, I don't know, cut some costs or refocus our efforts or something like that. So definitely there was some of that. Andy, what do you think about Bud Light moving forward on the back of this news?
So today, this is a few days ago. Today they reported their AB InBev reported their earnings for the latest quarter. The U.S. sales saw a 10.5% drop in volume, and the company blamed that on lower Bud Light volumes. And so, given all these stories put together, it's kind of easy to try and pin this on the influencer video, but I mean, your point about the need to appease their stakeholders is that's certainly appropriate. I mean, a lot of companies, particularly in the food and beverage sector, are seeing their earnings take a hit as inflation eases.
Mm-hmm.
Beer, particularly these large brewers in the U.S., they've had a sluggish time of it for a long, long time. And the fact that these are corporate roles rather than, you know, brewery or logistics workers, that doesn't strike me as a company in crisis. Yeah. So there are reasons behind it. You know, it's tough to say whether they're trying to just look like they're doing something, anything, maybe. But I don't know that there's you certainly feel for these people. These are, what, 380 people. But, it's hard for me to read too much more into it than that at this point.
Yeah. I think it's tough too for especially a company like Bud Light, and really for all food and beverage companies. If this is a vehicle maker, they can come up with a new model, you know, literally slap a new coat of paint on it. With Bud Light, what are you going to do from a product perspective? I mean, some would argue you should change the product a little bit, but overall, if it's been this popular, I mean, putting out a new can isn't going to help you here. I mean, you're not going to change the flavor.
They've already got Bud Light Seltzer. I'm not sure where else there is to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Bud Light Lemon. Let's do it.
I think did they try that?
Lime.
Bud Light Lime.
Oh, lime. Foolish me.
Yeah, it's a gap.
How could I not know that?
It's a gap in the market. You just
Are you going to call it Sinister Lemon?
I totally agree with a lot of what you guys are saying. And I do think it's kind of like a collage of reasons. We talked about this a few weeks back when this, you know, some of this stuff was the Modelo news came out that they had taken the Bud Light spot as the number one beer. There's a lot of market factors impacting big macro beer brands that we discussed at that time. And I agree. I think they still matter. You know, people are in the younger generations are drinking less beer. And people in all generations are drinking more craft beer and more seltzer and more NA drinks. And so for a brand like Bud Light, the market conditions are tough to begin with. That was something that they were starting with.
Yeah.
I agree that this is potentially, you know, maybe mildly related, but I think reading into the data too much to say that the influencer stuff is tanking this company in this kind of way, I don't think that's real. One of our website commenters remarked that the fiasco gave them cover to clear out the dead wood. Every organization needs to do this from time to time to restore efficiency to the operation. I thought that was interesting, if oversimplifying, but I do think that sometimes in times of crisis, it's easier to move people out. You don't really get the same kind of public blowback for job cuts. Like, no one is telling AB right now that they have to go back to the drawing board and like find the money somewhere. Like, they have the cover right now to do this. Yeah. And not to mention, they are following the lead of a lot of manufacturers right now who are cutting corporate positions, but not manufacturing ones. I mean, we've seen that from a lot of companies. I would be curious to know if this is a marketing department route or if they're looking at development people as they change to some of these newer products or different kind of unique products outside of beer. Hard to know, but yes, interesting nonetheless. All right. So before we move on to our final segment, which is in case you missed it, the stories that were less popular, but
so important.
So important, and you shouldn't have missed them. We have another word from our sponsor, BigCommerce. BigCommerce provides modern e-commerce technology that works with your existing systems. ERP, OMS, CRM, no problem. Whatever existing business tools and technologies you use today, BigCommerce can integrate using pre-built one-click integrations or customize your automation with its APIs. Make the move to BigCommerce today. I've talked to a lot of people from BigCommerce. They're really doing some interesting things with e-commerce and making it more off the shelf. And everybody there is super excited about it. It's actually pretty fun. So, all right. So, we're moving on to, in case you missed it. And today I thought we could start with Andy because he is the most excited.
That's right. I don't know. I didn't know how to react. I don't know what you were going to say there. And I was like, most excited. All right. We have a couple of bankruptcy related, in case you missed it, stories. That was kind of unintentional.
Yeah, yep.
For sure. It was unintentional, but I'll start with mine first. If you've been on the highway in the last few decades at any time,
I'm familiar. These
big orange or white semi trucks, big orange rectangle with the word yellow in them. I don't know why it's orange and not yellow, but that's not my call. So that's a company called Yellow Corporation. It's the third biggest trucking firm in the U.S., but it has had a rough couple of decades, and particularly the last few years. It got a $700 million federal loan during the pandemic to help as part of an effort, broader effort, to keep supply chains moving. In total, it has more than a billion dollars, I'm sorry, in total debt, and it only recently avoided a strike by the skin of its teeth from the Teamsters Union over millions in owed benefits. So last week, reports surfaced about its customers basically abandoning it wholesale over fears about its operations. And those, it turns out, were well-founded because the company shut down its operations on Sunday and was reportedly on the brink of filing for bankruptcy. Now, that corporate bankruptcies can allow companies to kind of reset things and reorganize things, but this company has been apparently mismanaged for so long that it's at the risk of outright liquidation.
Wow.
So there's a couple of issues here. First, Yellow has long been known as the lowest cost carrier of its kind in the industry. So companies that use it, which includes Walmart and Home Depot and other major retailers, are going to be forced to pay more to get their goods shipped now that Yellow is out of the equation. Secondly, that liquidation stands to impact about 30,000 workers. Now, you would hope that they would be able to find work quickly in either trucking or logistics, which are two industries that we've gone all over ad nauseum about their longstanding personnel issues. But that's a whole lot of lives upended, 30,000, 22,000 members of the Teamsters Union. As of press time right now, however, they have still apparently not filed anything in bankruptcy court. So and they have, I believe, told the Wall Street Journal that they're still working through some contingencies. So we'll have to see what happens there. But real upper. So I don't know why I was most excited. That's weird.
Don't worry. I have a bankruptcy story.
Very good.
Too. Jeff,
I'll bring it home. Don't worry, guys. Right.
We'll go to Jeff last. Jeff, what are your thoughts on the Yellow situation as they approach bankruptcy with 30,000 jobs being lost?
I mean, a couple of different things. I mean, this is like a staple of the supply chain. I mean, to see this company go down is really shocking. But as you alluded to, Andy, I mean, this also shows the fault in a business model of sort of being that low-cost leader, if you will, in a situation like this. Because obviously, they were lower cost, but they couldn't keep their doors open. So that's a problem, obviously. The other thing you do wonder is how this, you know, and you alluded to it from a logistics perspective. I mean, we hear about the fact that there's just this overwhelming shortage of long haul truck drivers. Well, I mean, you'd think those folks should not have an issue finding a job here, but, and hopefully they can make more money as well if they do find a new place to go. But in the short term, yeah, I think this is going to be felt throughout retail, really everywhere in terms of losing such a huge presence in the supply chain. It's going to be interesting to see how this falls out. Thankfully, you know, we had everything worked out with Teamsters and UPS, so there won't be sort of a double barrel effect there. We sort of got the railroad union situation figured out as well. Could you imagine if all of these things converged at once? We would be in a real nightmare situation. So we'll see what happens here in terms of if somebody else sort of steps up and grabs hold of some of these assets and these workers, or if what it leads to. It will be interesting to see the fallout from this one.
Yeah, for sure. And you're right when you say that it's an industry known for having a severe worker shortage. Trucking, long haul trucking, has been facing worker issues for many, many years. I was, I guess, pleased to see the ATA, which is the American Trucking Association, sent out a press release right after this news broke, within like a day, saying that in light of the announcement by Yellow that they were creating a new portal to help connect former Yellow workers to other career opportunities. Because for them, too, I'm sure they're seeing this and they're like, we need to jump on this talent to make sure that these people don't leave this critical, you know, skill set. Because obviously we need these folks. So hopefully they can, you know, pick up some of those workers and find them other opportunities in truck driving or logistics or what have you, wherever their skills are. But it remains to be seen. That's not always such a clean process as I think people want to suggest. Yeah. Like, oh, we have other opportunities. Like, well, where?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not always just a apples to apples comparison when it comes to jobs. So we'll have to see about that. But all right. So I will go next so we can end on a high note.
End the bankruptcy beat.
We are ending on, well, I don't want to set it up too much.
Oh, okay.
It's a better note.
It's a medium note.
Better.
All right. So the
it's super cool. You're going to love it.
The story I selected this week was titled Lawsuit to Hamper Lordstown's Bankruptcy Plan. We've talked a lot about Lordstown on the podcast and their terrible, terrible journey as an auto company. It just continues to get worse. So the Ohio-based EV company recently revealed that its partnership with Foxconn that intended to save it would actually result in bankruptcy. But it's how quickly that bankruptcy is permitted to take place that's now the issue. At the time of the June filing, Lordstown had said it hoped to sell its endurance vehicle and related assets, but U.S. bankruptcy judge Mary Walrath has rejected Lordstown's request for a quick bidding procedure that would allow bankruptcy to close by September. And that's because Lordstown is being sued, by California-based EV maker Karma for allegedly poaching its employees and stealing IP that Lordstown is accused of using in its infotainment system. And this news broke years ago, but it's just now going to trial. And in fact, that case was reportedly scheduled to go to trial in September. It was put on hold because of Lordstown's bankruptcy. And now Judge Walrath is saying that that Lordstown has to wait because they're like, you know, yeah. She said the critical issue in this case is whether the debtors own the property that they want to sell. She also added that the September deadline, quote, and this was harsh but fair, appears to be designed solely to get this done before a Karma decision can be made in the California litigation. She did not see through this one bit. So I thought this was an interesting development in the story because, you know, our podcast panel debated recently whether anything of value was left at Lordstown that could get picked up at auction or maybe even by a legacy automaker. And now I think any of those companies would be super hard pressed to get involved here. Right. I mean, interestingly, the judge pointed to the cash reserves that Lordstown has as evidence that they could stay afloat long enough to wait this out. So they're going to have to burn through even more money before they're even allowed to pull the plug, essentially, and try to sell some assets. But by then, those assets might not even belong to them. They might have, you know, it's not looking good for them to even be able to preserve any of the value that they have left. So I think we might have seen the last of Lordstown.
Yeah. Andy, I think Taps is beginning to play here. What do you think?
I was going to ask. Well, first of all, I was going to ask what Karma was hoping to get out of a bankrupt company, but apparently that's been answered because they have some cash lying around still somehow. But I was also like, was there ever any other outcome here? Like,
well, one of the
this was always nothing proceeds as it's supposed to with this company.
No.
Why should its bankruptcy proceeding be anything different?
Well, I was the one who was optimistic. I thought another car company would potentially be interested in the IP. But at this point, even if that's the case, Lordstown as an entity with this type of lawsuit, if it's got, because correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Karma coming after saying they stole people?
People too, yeah.
And was it some intellectual property as well?
Yeah.
So that IP may not even be theirs to sell once this hits. So I just, this is one of those, again, we've talked about this. We wanted this to work so badly. And at every turn, it just was not meant to be.
Such a good story in theory.
It was. And remember when like that GM plant closed and then everyone was like, yay, a new automaker is going to buy it. And then it just was even worse.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jeff, where are you at with this medium temper story here? Let's hear it.
Well, you know, it's hard to make a car, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
But maybe not so tough or getting easier or, I don't know, simpler to make an automated electric crop duster. Because the FAA recently approved an automated electric crop duster for commercial use. So Pika, it's a manufacturer of large-scale automated electric aircraft for crop protection and cargo transport, has received FAA approval to operate its Pelican spray aircraft for crop protection commercially nationwide. So the basic gist here is it's a smaller plane. It's obviously unmanned, so you don't need a pilot in there. And it's also got a lot of built-in efficiencies around it. So not only is it smaller, potentially more affordable, but it's already in operation in farms kind of in Central America. It can carry up to 540 pounds of liquid spray, and it's also much more efficient. It can be more targeted in terms of where it drops the pesticide, so it's releasing less of it than you would with a traditional crop duster. So it just seems like another one of these advancements when we look at the important role that farmers and agriculture play in our society around the world, this is another way to bring technology a little bit closer to more widespread use. Again, you don't need to fire your pilot's license. You don't need to hire a pilot. So potentially, even though it's a huge investment initially in something like this, and it's not for, you know, a 100-acre dairy farm, it is for a larger scale application. The fact that it does remove some of those costs, levels the playing field a little bit, and also is better in terms of less chemical being used, less fuel being used. These are all positive advancements that I think is just, it's great to see, again, when the application is something we all use every day, food.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I think it's a great combination of application and technology.
Yeah, I agree. And you say that it's more for large operations, and I largely agree. But don't you think as a service, this could be utilized for small farms? Because they already contract that out. It's not like they have their own planes. So, I think that's a really interesting option for some of those rural areas that they're kind of sharing resources there. And again, being more targeted with the application of this, because we know that rampant wild like pesticide spraying is not doing us any favors, right? So, right. Andy, what do you think about the plane?
I mean, this we've talked about technology like this before. This is always crop dusting drones, if that's the term they want to use or not. That's always kind of been considered one of the first potential applications for autonomous aircraft, mostly because there's going to be a market for it, but also just because they're flying in less crowded areas, generally speaking. So it's good to see, and you would think it would just get more efficient and less expensive as we move along here.
Yeah, I would think so. All right, so we're about wrapping up here, but I think we got some time here for a couple final thoughts. Andy, is your final thought, thank God it's over?
No, this was a fun one. Oh, okay. Sometimes
you made lots of friends.
Sometimes, yeah. We'll see what my email looks like when we're done. I'll be less excited.
Andy at IEN.com.
That's right. No, it was fun. This was a good one. I feel like we'll see.
Thanks for coming.
Of course. I struggle with the final thought more than I probably should, because I know it's just kind of a, you know, final thought.
My wife makes fun of me all the time. Why'd you have such a weak final thought?
I did come up with one
kind
though.
Of a bully.
I was hanging out with my in-laws this weekend, and we heard like a podcast ad or something. And they were talking about how every podcast voice has the same cadence to it. And I was thinking after the fact, except for this one, this is the only one I don't think that has embraced the true crime podcast.
Oh, like this one?
That's the one. Yeah. There it is.
It's because we're untrained.
Okay. I was wondering if that was something you were actively avoiding or came naturally or something you aspire to.
We're just bad at this.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
No one told us how to do that, so we're not going to do it.
I think we should blame it on the producers.
They're right.
Thanks, guys.
They're listening.
They're in the room.
So anyway, I don't know if that's a compliment or an insult, but I thought it was noteworthy.
I'll take it as both.
There you go. You got it.
My final thought this week is my son got stung by, I believe, a wasp over the weekend on his foot. And I thought this was funny. He screamed for like, I don't know, a minute. And then I put some water on it because we were at the park. And so I just like, you know, when you just pretend like you have a plan. It's like, let's put some water on it. And then he was just cool. And so it's been like super red. All the way like across his entire foot. And then last night, his whole foot was bruised, which I read is common with wasp stings. But he just does not care. And I just was like,
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, are you fine? I'm like putting hydrocortisone cream on it and making him take baths and stuff. And he's like, yeah, I'm good. I'm like, all right. So the moral of the story is kids are the best. They like handle things so much better than adults. I don't know why he's like... just this tiny little guy, and he's good. He's good to go.
So at the top or the bottom of the foot?
On the top. And so
that's a break, I think. On the bottom seems like it'd be so much worse. You had to walk on it then.
I guess so. Yeah. I don't know. But there's like nothing there, you know, like the top of your foot it's just foot bone.
I got stung. This is a few years ago now, but I got stung on my toe just walking in sandals through a park. Mm-hmm. And I whined about that for a while. So kudos.
Well, I know. Every time I get stung, I'm like a huge baby about it. Yeah. But he was just like, whatever, let's move on, everybody. All right, Jeff, let's have it. What's your weak final thought?
My weak final thought. Well, I think it's pretty solid this time.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, interesting segue. I was telling you about when my daughter got stung. We were down at the farmer's market first time and had to run into Walgreens for a bag of frozen peas to throw on her arm because she was she felt it for a couple hours. I mean, it was bugging her, but she did move on. And interestingly enough, that little girl is turning 20 years old this weekend. So it's one of those moments where it's like, wow.
Yeah.
How do I feel about this? I mean, she got to 20, okay. But like that makes me feel really old.
Yeah.
That combined with the fact that my middle daughter's starting college at the end of the month, my youngest daughter's going into her last year of high school. It makes me appreciate things like August 4th, which is International Beer Day. Did you know of this?
That's,
and you know what a great
that's
way
tomorrow.
To celebrate International Beer Day? Which one, Andy?
I mean, dealer's choice. There's fancy koozie on there, so I can't tell which is which.
Want that one?
Sure.
So, yeah, just another way to enjoy the Today in Manufacturing Beer Cozy.
This isn't weak at all.
This isn't weak at all. See, honey, I told
Come
you.
Come on.
Perron, this is the best one.
Good work.
Cheers.
Here we cheers. Go. Cheers. Cheers. Cheers, producers. Nameless.
Yeah, we let them have a beer
nameless
now.
Nameless producers.
Because if they knew they were having beer before the podcast started, this would have been even more of a debacle.
Cheers. It might have been even better.
Cheers, you hang that
as a carrot toward the end of the episode.
So happy International Beer Day to everybody.
Thanks,
because
Jeff.
Because that's wonderful. Thanks. And there's a couple more people who can also be enjoying their beer in this wonderful Today Manufacturing Beer Cozy. If you want one of these, just let us know. What did I say?
Cozy.
I said cozy. Cozy. Sorry. You know, let us know what you would or would not put into these Today Manufacturing podcast beer koozies, can koozies. Mm. We did have a couple people chime in. B said she would not put they would not put a Zima in a koozie. Oh, wait. If I could actually buy Zima, they would. So
is it not available anymore?
I have not seen Zima.
I think they revived it briefly.
Oh,
if memory serves.
Okay.
Didn't stand the test of time.
It might have been a publicity stunt.
Crystal also wrote in, and she'll be getting a koozie as well. She said she put a Twisted Tea in the koozie, but no energy drinks, especially not Red Bull.
Oh, yeah.
They don't fit, right?
Kind of a thinner can.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might need a little extra. But yeah, I'm not the energy drink fan, as you could be attested to last week when we tried Prime.
Prime.
That was definitely a fail.
I showed you guys this already, but I found a pallet of Prime here in town.
And you left you left it alone, right?
I did not buy the palette.
Crystal also, she's actually a great listener in the only Wanakee in the world. And she said that they also had them in a local grocery store too, if we were interested. So Prime that is.
Hmm.
Not the beer koozie. Those you got to let us know for. So
what was your plan if David was here? Just make him drink a beer?
No, I was actually going to try to find like the least beer-like beer available.
Yeah.
Like to me, that's like a Line and Kugel's Berry Vice or something like that.
Yeah,
make
him drink a Berry Vice. That would be hilarious.
I mean, especially with covering a flu, recovering from the flu. I'm sure the beer would be perfect.
I got a story about Berry Vice. I'll tell you off the air.
Ooh.
It's nothing criminal. It's fine. It's harmless.
Were these people that you also despise and think are the worst in the world or no?
I mean, maybe they think that about me afterward, but.
Okay. There you go.
Well,
good luck wrapping this one up, Anna.
Yeah, keep sending us your thoughts, and you can get your own koozie. It's very effective, as you can see. All right, that's it for today. Please make sure to like, subscribe to, and share the podcast. And to email us, of course, you can reach us at Jeff, Anna, or Andy at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. Please subscribe to our daily and weekly e-newsletters and like us on YouTube. That's important. We'll show up whenever we want on YouTube. So for Jeff and Andy, I'm Anna, and for David.
Get well, David.
Remotely, get well soon. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.